Talk given Friday, 7th May 1976. We have heard the most recent news of natural disaster, the earthquake, extending over such a vast area of Europe. And we can well appreciate what that entails in terms of human suffering. Not only death, which perhaps comes as a terrible shock, but it is done with. But also people who are maimed for life, or whose minds become unhinged, who have lost homes, friends, contacts with those who are near and dear to them, and so forth. Mankind is always afflicted with some sort of illness, some sort of hurt. And the millions of the world suffer because of upsets of health. The question arises, how shall we, who are concerned with realizing what it means to live the religious life in the deepest sense, the question arises, how do we approach and understand this kind of pain, disaster, sorrow, illness, which sweeps over us? There is a very interesting presentation of this kind of situation where personal illness and approaching death, inevitable death, is concerned in the Buddhist teachings, a presentation which is, I believe, quite unusual. I haven't come across it in other religious teachings. When any one of the monks, that is to say, one of the people completely dedicated to living the religious life and realizing the summum bonum, was desperately ill, some of the most senior monks, and sometimes perhaps the Buddha himself, visited the man, the monk. And sometimes the conversation would proceed as follows. After starting in one particular set form, the Buddha or the senior monks ask the sick man, How are you feeling now? Are your pains subsiding? Are you able to bear up? And of course, these are instances where the monk dies. So the monk says that he finds that the pains are in fact increasing, they are not diminishing, and he's finding it extremely difficult to bear up. And then comes one very interesting form in which the conversation proceeds. There are several forms, at least three or four different forms. The senior monk or the Buddha asks the sick man, "What do you think? Is the body nitya or anitya?" I'm using the Sanskrit words. In Pali, nitya or anitya. Nitya means eternal. A better meaning is absolute. Anicca means impermanent, and a better way of looking at it is relative. Is the body absolute or relative? Eternal or impermanent? And the monk says, I'll use the usual translation, impermanent, Lord. Then, is it right wisdom to regard that which is impermanent, which is not the absolute, as this is the ultimate reality, the artha, the self as it is translated? Not very happy translation to use the word self there. Atta literally means ultimate reality. Is it wise to say this, referring to the body, is mine? This am I. And the monk answers, no, Lord, that is not right wisdom. Then, says the Buddha, relinquish that which is impermanent, which is not the absolute. Do not grasp it. And this formula is repeated with respect to all feelings, thoughts, ideas, beliefs, mental conformations, patterns of mind, and consciousness itself. In short, all that we who exist as individuals can be aware of in the world of manifestation as constituting us, totally constituting us. Relinquish it completely, do not grasp at it. Now wisdom lies, practical wisdom lies in really understanding this and seeing it. There's no profit in merely accepting it, merely believing it. One has to consider it with one's whole being. Note the way the matter is presented. If and because it is not the transcendent, not the absolute, not the eternal, not the ultimate reality, do not grasp it. Shortly afterwards, after the conversation, when either the Buddha or the senior monks leave, the monk, of course, dies. There are instances in which he dies because he commits suicide, as we would say. The phrase used in those days was, takes the knife unto himself, puts an end to the body, which has become altogether unbearable and incurable. And it is very significant that the Buddha says there is no blame to be attached to that man. He died blamelessly because he took the knife to himself with his mind utterly free of all grasping at the relative, the impermanent, that which inevitably perishes. Body, feelings, thoughts, mental patterns, consciousness itself, it all perishes. It has come into being, it will inevitably perish after it has had its day. Now, at first glance, it looks as if this is a heartless, terrible way of regarding it. But is it? Is it heartless, or is it expressive of supreme understanding and compassion? When disease has gone to that limit, then let go, completely let go. The senior monks nor the Buddha call in the doctor at that stage. They always inquire, have you had your medicines, have you had your treatments and so forth? And the monk says, yes, Lord, I have had the medicines, I have had all the treatments, I have had those who have attended on me in my illness. But in spite of that, this is it. Then the time has come to be attentive only to the transcendent real and let go the impermanent. For us who continue to live, some of us are young, some middle-aged, some of us, at least I am, old. There's a tremendous lesson to be learned out of this. A lesson to be learned not only out of what is in the scriptures, in the Buddhist texts as such, but out of our own personal illnesses which afflict us throughout our lives. Little colds and coughs and pains and whatnot and whatnot. They all come. What is this lesson which we have to learn? Not to grasp at the perpetuation of our selfness. To call in the doctor when one is ill is essentially right, practical, sensible. To take the medicines is essentially right, practical, and sensible. But we have to go deeper than that. Whilst we are doing what is in itself sensible and right, what is our attitude? What is our state of mind? What are the changes that take place in our mind from day to day, from hour to hour of the illness? In what manner are we conscious of ourself, of the event which we are going through, the event of our illness, our pain? Or the illness and pain of those very dear and near to us, or not so dear and near? What is our inner attitude? Is it one of the blind animal urge wanting self-perpetuation? What happens when we get a pain? What happens in the mind? The mind immediately feels, oh, I want to get rid of this, it's unpleasant. But the attitude of I want to get rid of it, it is unpleasant, is something which feeds our self-orientedness, our self-center. It doesn't release us into our true humanness, our true individuality, indivisibility. True individuality means not only that the particular organism, psychophysical organism that goes by our name, is a harmonious whole with all its different aspects in right relationship with each other, but it means something immensely profounder than that. It means that one is in wholly harmonious relationship with the totality, with our environment, not only our immediate environment, but with the total environment, which is the entire universe. Then one is the true individual. Why? Because in his awareness, he doesn't separate himself out from the total not-self, as we call it. Now, when this is the case, the human creature has gone beyond being a source of ill or evil to himself or to his environment in any shape and form. Because this non-grasping for self, this wide-awake attentiveness whilst one is ill, and I know from personal experience, when the illness is bad enough or annoying enough, how extremely difficult it is to maintain, to remain in that state of clear awareness. But the remaining in that state of clear awareness, in the time of trouble, physical illness, of mental distress, of sorrow or any accident or terrible event anywhere, remaining awake like that means that oneself essentially is not ill. The person manifests inner wholeness, inner harmony through the medium of the temporarily ill state, the disturbed, the sorrowful state. If one practices the discipline of the religious life earnestly, sincerely, and this is one of the deep meanings of yoga, one experiences some quite remarkable things within oneself because of the illness, because of the sorrow. First and foremost, quite simply, you experience the state of compassionateness for all who suffer. And who is there? What is there in the world that doesn't suffer in some form or other? One experiences compassionateness with a depth of meaning which one doesn't experience when one is just well and happy and successful and all the rest of it. This we may apply to another sphere of life, the relationship between two people who are close together, as man and wife, parent and child, brother and sister, or whoever they may be, whatever the relationship may be. You know how in modern times, people more and more easily walk out on the other person because of some reason or other. And if we look at the reason, we will see in almost all cases that the self has been offended. One's ego, one's vanity has been hurt. One's ambitions have been thwarted. One's passion to dominate has brought back a tremendous reaction from the other person. And so on, endless reasons. Or just the passion of the day, the year, the 10 years is over, and so the relationship is broken. One walks out upon it. But when that happens, it is a sign that the very depth of understanding, the very heart of compassion has not yet been released in oneself. Not only that, it is a confession of one's backwardness, one's inability to live religiously. I'm going to use the Sanskrit word dharmically. Dharma is religion, it is the teaching, it is the way of the religious life. What does dharma mean, essentially? derived from the root dhri, it means to uphold. What is it that each single creature in the world, each single object in the world has to uphold? Not an imposed system of commandments or laws or beliefs or anything at all. Essentially, one has to uphold, I'm again going to use the word from the Rig Veda, Ritta. Ritta, from which our English word right, R-I-T-E, as also R-I-G-H-T, are derived. Ritta means the eternal order of things, the inherent harmony within the constitution of every single object and every single creature, which brings into being, maintains, and transforms a cosmos, not chaos. Therefore, this means brings to fulfillment everything in the universe. That is Ritta. And Dharma means the upholding of this Ritta. In the yoga system, we have the different aspects of yoga presented, the moralities, the religious observances, the postures and the breathing, the withdrawal, the real freedom from attachment and aversion to the sense, to the objects of sense and sense experiences, pratyahara, and then dharana, the upholding. Dharana is another word for it. The upholding of this eternal order of things. And if we fail as human beings to uphold in the human way the eternal order of things, the purpose of our existence is not fulfilled. You see how profound and deep are things of religion, and how lovely they are, really. How they all coalesce into a wonderful cosmic order, which it is our business to uphold. Now, all the experience that we go through, our illnesses, our pains, our frustrations, our losses, as well as their complementary duals, the successes and the joys and the good health, as we call it, and so forth and so forth. If in all these things we learn how to remain awake to the transcendent reality and to be utterly free of grasping at anything whatsoever, utterly free of all grasping, then we have fulfilled, we are fulfilling the purpose of our existence. Then we are true humans. Then we are creative in the real sense by being in complete tune with this extraordinary creative pulse of the entire universal process without our knowing it. And we mustn't try to know it in terms of concepts, of ideas, of pictures of the mind. Because if we try to do that, then we are making the error, we are guilty of the error of trying to pack the cosmos into our teacup. Can't be done. In any case, we just don't know how. Don't know in our ordinary sense of the word know. But we know in the transcendent sense, the sense in which Plato used the word know, the sense in which in India we have used the word vidya, knowledge. Namely, we are that which we know. We are a harmony, essentially and in actual manifestation, therefore, whether the body and the feelings and the mind, the intellect, are in distress or not in distress, in the state of what we commonly call illness or not, or health, what we commonly call health. See, this is a great mystery. Until we really experience this, when this atonement, which naturally flowers into being because of our complete freedom from grasping for self, when this comes into being, then we are this cosmic harmony. One should not regard this as a way of consoling ourselves. To seek consolation is a mistake. What do we mean by consolation? We are in a state of pain and we want that pain to be wiped out. No. The pain will inevitably go away sooner or later in some form or other. Just as the pleasure, the healthy state, will also change in some form into something else. That will happen inevitably. But consolation means, in actual practice, a benumbing of our mode of consciousness, our mode of awareness. We want to be anesthetized emotionally. We feel the need for it. Now it is perfectly true that the human organism, I as I am, a frail mortal, am incapable always of living at that. At that level, in that depth. There are circumstances in life which are so overwhelmingly painful that one, to use an ordinary phrase, gives up the ghost. That's perfectly true. But you will also find a very beautiful and almost miraculous thing happening. If one doesn't give up the ghost, if one goes through the experience calmly, quietly, enduring, not caring what the end point will be. If one does that, because of the release of extraordinary compassionateness and insight into the nature of reality which arises within oneself, the external circumstance changes and in some curious way help comes. It just appears. We say quite unexpectedly, oh, by sheer chance, this is the only way we talk about it, by sheer chance, so-and-so came along and, the whole situation changed. He advised me this or gave me that, and lo and behold, things changed. This is the kind of thing that does happen because the universe responds to one's freedom from all selfness. When there is this freedom from all selfness, the energies of the universe flow unimpeded into one, effect their transformation within one, and flow out, enriched, helping the environment, again, without our knowing it. And this is the beauty of things. Again, remember the words of the Buddha, that the Dharma is lovely in the beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely in the end. And regard the Dharma in this context not merely as the teaching, the doctrine, and the practice, and so forth, but as the upholding of the eternal order of things. And if that is done, think, just try to imagine, and it really is quite unimaginable, but try to imagine the immensity of the energies which are allowed free play through you, one single little creature. If this is experienced even once in real intensity, one undergoes an extraordinary transformation. Has it ever struck anybody that one of the significances of Gethsemane and crucifixion is just that? Jesus knew precisely the pain of crucifixion. His father Joseph was a carpenter, and it is said that he made crosses on which criminals were crucified, and the boy Jesus assisted him. Think of that sensitive child. What sort of a play may have taken place in his imagination in this matter? And there came the time when he himself was to be laid on a cross. How and why should the sinless Son of God, the pure Son of Man, have suffered so terribly at Gethsemane, at the approaching event? The death, in one of the most painful forms, which was the supreme gift of transcendence. And remember that death for each and every one of us is the ultimate and supreme gift of transcendence, which releases us from enclosed, finite existence an existence means a standing out of the transcendent reality, a separation from it. It is the supreme gift at the end by which this is restored in complete, in full, utter measure to that infinite, absolute, transcendent real. This is the deepest meaning of the root of the word yoga, yuj. So, let us understand pain, illness, sorrow. Understand it transcendentally, not just with the brain, not just a pattern of thoughts and ideas of emotions, but with this profound understanding which is the real enlightenment.